Chapter 38. Strong, let them do so now. With this view she made a toilet which differed from all else he had ever attempted before. To heighten her natural attraction had hitherto been the unvarying endeavor of her adult life, and one in which she was no novice. But now she neglected this, and even proceeded to impair the natural presentation. Beyond a natural reason for her slightly drawn look, as he had not slept all the previous night, and this had produced upon her pretty, though slightly worn features the aspect of a countenance aging prematurely from extreme sorrow. She selected as much from want of spirit as design her poorest, plainest, and longest discarded attire. To avoid the contingency of being recognized, she veiled herself, and slipped out of the house quickly. The sun was resting on the hill like a drop of blood on an eyelid by the time as he had got up the road opposite the amphitheater, which he speedily entered. The interior was shadowy, and emphatic of the absence of every living thing. She was not disappointed in the fearful hope with which she awaited him. Henchard came over the top, descended, and Lucetta waited breathlessly. But having reached the arena she saw a change in his bearing. He stood still at a little distance from her. She could not think why. Nor could anyone else have known. The truth was that in appointing this spot, and this hour, for the rendezvous, Lucetta had unwittingly backed up her entreaty by the strongest argument she could have used outside words, with this man of moods, glooms, and superstitions. Her figure in the midst of the huge enclosure, the unusual plainness of her dress, her attitude of hope and appeal, so strongly revived in his soul the memory of another ill-used woman who had stood there, and thus in bygone days, and had now passed away into her rest, that he was unmanned, and his heart smote him for having attempted reprisals on one of a sex so weak. When he approached her, and before as he had spoken a word, her point was half gained. His manner as he had come down had been one of cynical carelessness. But he now put away his grim half-smile, and said in a kindly subdued tone, "Good night, Ty. Of course I am glad to come, if you want me." "Oh, thank you," she said apprehensively. "I am sorry to see you looking so ill," he stammered with unconcealed compunction. She shook her head. "How can you be sorry," she asked, "when you deliberately cause it?" "What?" said Henchard uneasily. "Is it anything I have done that has pulled you down like that?" "It is all your doing," she said. "Have no other grief. My happiness would be secure enough, but for your threats. Oh, Michael, don't wreck me like this. You might think that you have done enough. When I came here I was a young woman. Now I am rapidly becoming an old one. Neither my husband nor any other man will regard me with interest long." Henchard was disarmed. His old feeling of supercilious pity for womankind in general was intensified by this suppliant appearing here as the double of the first. Moreover, that thoughtless want of foresight which had led to all her trouble remained with poor Lucetta still, as he had come to meet him here in this compromising way without perceiving the risk. Such a woman was very small deer to hunt. He felt ashamed, lost all zest and desire to humiliate Lucetta there and then, and no longer envied Farfrae his bargain. He had married money, but nothing more. Henchard was anxious to wash his hands of the game. "Well, what do you want me to do?" he said gently. "I'm sure I shall be very willing. My reading of those letters was only a sort of practical joke, and I revealed nothing. To give me back the letters, and any papers you may have that breathe of matrimony or worse. So be it. Every scrap shall be yours, but, between you and me, Lucetta, he is sure to find out something of the matter, sooner or later." "Ah," she said with eager tremulousness. "But not till I have proved myself a faithful and deserving wife to him, and then he may forgive me everything." Henchard silently looked at her. He almost envied Farfrae such love as that, even now. "I hope so," he said. "But you shall have the letters without fail. And your secret shall be kept. I swear it. How good you are, how shall I get them?" He reflected, and said he would send them the next morning. "Now don't doubt me," he added. can keep my word. 36. Returning from her appointment, Lucetta saw a man waiting by the lamp nearest to her own door. When she stopped to go in, he came and spoke to her. It was Jop. He begged her pardon for addressing her. But he had heard that Mr. Farfrey had been applied to by a neighboring corn merchant to recommend a working partner. If so, he wished to offer himself. He could give good security, and had stated as much to Mr. Farfrey in a letter. But he would feel much obliged if Lucetta would say a word in his favor to her husband. It is a thing I know nothing about, said Lucetta coldly. But you can testify to my trustworthiness better than anybody, ma'am, said Jop. Was in Jersey several years, and knew you there by sight. Indeed, she replied. But I knew nothing of you. I think, ma'am, that a word or two from you would secure for me what I covet very much, he persisted. She steadily refused to have anything to do with the affair, and cutting him short, because of her anxiety to get indoors before her husband should miss her, left him on the pavement. He watched her till as he had vanished, and then went home. When he got there, he sat down in the fireless chimney corner looking at the iron dogs, and the wood laid across them for heating the morning kettle. A movement upstairs disturbed him, and Henchard came down from his bedroom, where he seemed to have been rummaging boxes. I wish, said Henchard, you would do me a service, Jop, now tonight, I mean, if you can. Leave this at Mrs. Farfrey's for her. I should take it myself, of course, but I don't wish to be seen there. He handed a package in brown paper, sealed. Henchard had been as good as his word. Immediately on coming indoors, he had searched over his few belongings, and every scrap of Lucetta's writing that he possessed was here. Jop indifferently expressed his willingness. Well, how have he got on today? His lodger asked. Nigh prospect of an opening? I am afraid not, said Jop, who had not told the other of his application to Farfrey. There never will be in Casterbridge, declared Henchard decisively. Who must roam further afield? He said good night to Jop, and returned to his own part of the house. Jop sat until his eyes were attracted by the shadow of the candle snuff on the wall, and looking at the original, he found that it had formed itself into a head like a red-hot cauliflower. Henchard's packet next met his gaze. He knew there had been something of the nature of wooing between Henchard and the now Mrs. Farfrey, and his vague ideas on the subject narrowed themselves down to these. Henchard had a parcel belonging to Mrs. Farfrey, and he had reasons for not returning that parcel to her in person. What could be inside it? So he went on and on till, animated by resentment at Lucetta's haughtiness, as he thought it, and curiosity to learn if there were any weak sides to this transaction with Henchard, he examined the package. The pen and all its relations being awkward tools in Henchard's hands, he had affixed the seals without an impression, it never occurring to him that the efficacy of such a fastening depended on this. Jop was far less of a tyro. He lifted one of the seals with his penknife, peeped in at the end thus opened, saw that the bundle consisted of letters, and, having satisfied himself thus far, sealed up the end again by simply softening the wax with the candle, and went off with the parcel as requested. His path was by the riverside at the foot of the town. Coming into the light at the bridge which stood at the end of High Street, he beheld lounging thereon Mother Cuxham and Nance Mockridge. We be just going down Mixon Lane way, to look into Peter's finger afore creeping to bed, said Mrs. Cuxham. Here's a fiddle and tambourine going on there. Lord, what's all the world do ye come along to? Jop, twan't hinder ye 5 minutes. Jop had mostly kept himself out of this company, but present circumstances made him somewhat more reckless than usual, and without many words he decided to go to his destination that way. Though the upper part of Durnover was mainly composed of a curious congeries of barns and farmsteads, there was a less picturesque side to the parish. This was Mixon Lane, now in great part pulled down. Mixon Lane was the adalum of all the surrounding villages. It was the hiding place of those who were in distress, and in debt, and trouble of every kind. Farm laborers and other peasants, who combined a little poaching with their farming, and a little brawling and bibbing with their poaching, found themselves sooner or later in Mixon Lane. Rural mechanics too idle to mechanize, rural servants too rebellious to serve, drifted or were forced into Mixon Lane. The lane and its surrounding thicket of thatched cottages stretched out like a spit into the moist and misty lowland. Much that was sad, much that was low, some things that were baneful, could be seen in Mixon Lane. Vice ran freely in and out certain of the doors in the neighborhood. Recklessness dwelt under the roof with the crooked chimney, shame in some bow windows, theft in times of privation, in the thatched and mud-walled houses by the sallows. Even slaughter had not been altogether unknown here. In a block of cottages up an alley there might have been erected an altar to disease in years gone by. Such was Mixon Lane in the times when Henchard and Farfrae were mayors. Yet this mildewed leaf in the sturdy and flourishing Casterbridge plant lay close to the open country, not 100 yards from a row of noble elms, and commanding a view across the moor of airy uplands and cornfields, and mansions of the great. A brook divided the moor from the tenements, and to outward view there was no way across it, no way to the houses, but round about by the road. But under every householder's stairs there was kept a mysterious plank 9 inches wide, which plank was a secret bridge. If you, as one of those refugee householders, came in from business after dark, and this was the business time here, you stealthily crossed the moor, approached the border of the aforesaid brook, and whistled opposite the house to which you belonged. A shape thereupon made its appearance on the other side, bearing the bridge on end against the sky. It was lowered, you crossed, and a hand helped you to land yourself, together with the pheasants and hares gathered from neighboring manors. You sold them slyly the next morning, and the day after you stood before the magistrates with the eyes of all your sympathizing neighbors concentrated on your back. You disappeared for a time. Then you were again found quietly living in Mixon Lane. Walking along the lane at dusk, the stranger was struck by two or three peculiar features there. One was an intermittent rumbling from the back premises of the inn halfway up. This meant a skittle alley. Another was the extensive prevalence of whistling in the various domiciles, a pipe note of some kind coming from nearly every open door. Another was the frequency of white aprons over dingy gowns among the women around the doorways. A white apron is a suspicious vesture in situations where spotlessness is difficult. Moreover, the industry and cleanliness which the white apron expressed were belied by the postures and gaits of the women who wore it, their knuckles being mostly on their hips, an attitude which lent them the aspect of two-handled mugs, and their shoulders against doorposts. While there was a curious alacrity in the turn of each honest woman's head upon her neck, and in the twirl of her honest eyes, at any noise resembling a masculine footfall along the lane. Yet amid so much that was bad, needy respectability also found a home. Under some of the roofs abode pure and virtuous souls whose presence there was due to the iron hand of necessity, and to that alone. Families from decayed villages, families of that once bulky, but now nearly extinct, section of village society called Iviers, or lifeholders, copyholders, and others, whose roof trees had fallen for some reason or other, compelling them to quit the rural spot that had been their home for generations, came here, unless they chose to lie under a hedge by the wayside. The inn called Peter's Finger was the church of Mixon Lane. It was centrally situate, as such places should be, and bore about the same social relation to the three mariners as the latter bore to the King's Arms. At first sight, the inn was so respectable as to be puzzling. The front door was kept shut, and the step was so clean that evidently but few persons entered over its sanded surface. But at the corner of the public house was an alley, a mere slit, dividing it from the next building. Halfway up the alley was a narrow door, shiny and paintless from the rub of infinite hands and shoulders. This was the actual entrance to the inn. A pedestrian would be seen abstractedly passing along Mixon Lane, and then, in a moment, he would vanish, causing the gazer to blink like Ashton at the disappearance of Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.